Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Today's Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. Since our last episode, we've seen the Premier League relegation picture become an awful lot clearer. We've seen the Championship promotion picture pretty much settled, barring the playoffs, of course. We've seen two English sides into each of the European semi-finals. We've seen the back of Jose Mourinho out, and we've also seen a Super League of greed and self-interest announced and then destroyed in the space of 48 hours. Plus, following that, the unrest stirred up by that drama resulting in fan protests at Old Trafford, causing Man United and Liverpool to be postponed. So it's been a quiet month then. Here with me to give their verdict on it all are our own Super Elite contributors who, just like a good Super League founding member, will never be relegated. We've got Stephen Bell today. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm good, Aid. Yeah, looking forward to getting into all this. As you say, it's been a busy month. Not sure what we can cram into one podcast, but we'll have a go.
Yeah, we'll do our best. Matthew Gibbs as well. Evening, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, spot on. You know, plenty of meaty stuff for us to get into again today.
I'll say.
And last but not least is Paul McParlin. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, and thanks for having me on. It's good to be a legacy fan on these sorts of shows, you know.
Yes, we take pride in our legacy status, absolutely. Well, let's start with the present then. As we record this, this is Sunday as we record it, so we're fresh from the incident at Old Trafford. We've seen protests initially outside the stadium today, but spilling through into the stadium itself and then onto the pitch against the Glazers ownership, and this has resulted in the match against Liverpool being postponed. Now, and I guess the repercussions of this will no doubt come out in the coming days. But my first thoughts on it all, Stephen, coming to you as our Man United guy. And it's all been stirred up by the Super League plans, of course. But what are your thoughts on what has happened at Old Trafford today?
Yeah, I think what's happened is a lot of years of discontent, deep discontent that's festered away and festered away and festered away. And then the Super League announcement and the Super League debacle has pushed United fans over some sort of cliff edge. They've felt the club get further and further away from them in many ways, so many ways. That partly comes down to the Glazers, it comes to the end of the Ferguson era, changes from top to bottom, boardroom level, change from top to bottom on the field. It's no longer the club that so many Manchester United fans fell in love with, myself included. And that's largely down to the Glazers. You know, we see so many, it's a case of which devil do you want to get into bed with, I think, with ownership these days. Do you want an oligarch? Do you want a state-funded club that's in league with, all kinds of dastardly deeds? Who knows what kind of blood money is involved in these takeovers? Or do you want somebody that sucks the life out of the club, sucks the money out of the club? And I think that's been going on for so long now. United fans went through a period of time where they just learnt to accept it, I think, or the majority of United fans learnt to accept it as this is the way things are now. I always think there's been an hardcore, which I'm not involved with, an hardcore of United fans who've refused to accept it. And this Super League announcement and the attitude of the owners, I think, I think they've been the weakest ones in terms of explanations and apologies. I think that's really, really reared up anger and feelings that's festered away for many years.
Will this continue? And Paul, come to you on this as well. Now, do you think this kind of thing will continue at other discontented fan bases too? I mean, this hornet's nest as Stephen put it, hasn't been, no, it's been stirred up, not just in Manchester, of course. You know, Arsenal fans are protesting Kroenke. There's been murmurs of FSG at Liverpool and all this kind of thing. Will this, obviously the momentum of fan protest is picking up. Do you think we'll see similar, if not exactly the same, but, you know, similar protests at others?
Well, I think to some extent we already have it. I mean, the protest before the last Arsenal home league fixture, obviously there were the protests of the Chelsea fans on Stamford Bridge when the ESL was first announced. So, yeah, I think there probably might well be a knock-on and some form of continuation. I think with Man United as well, I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, they've always had quite a radical element of the support. I mean that in a good way, because when the Glazers first took over, you know, one of the process, they did the quiet, visible process of all the fans wearing yellow and green scarves, you know, after Newton Heath, the original Man United club, which, let's not forget, was founded by railway workers. And that was a real, that creates a real impact, and people, you know, it generated conversation about why you're wearing those scarves. That then led to the formation of FC United, which is, you know, a club owned by Man United fans who are fed up with the Glazers, who wanted to create the almost ideal version of what fan ownership in a football club should look like. I think there's always been that tradition there. I think that they led the way in protest against ticket prices as well. And, you know, although I have reservations about the game being called off, I have reservations about actually breaking into the stage. I don't condone that. But the actual process, I thought, were totally justified. And, you know, there comes a time in every football fan's life when you have to look at where your club is, and you would know this from your experience being a Newcastle fan, Aidan. I have to make a decision of how much longer am I going to put up with this for? And you know, there comes a crossing the Rubicon moment, and I think the announcement of the ESL was the final thing that's kind of galvanised maybe the quieter, more accepting elements of the supporter base to actually come back and react. And of course, it's quite interesting if you look at the history of Man United, because Stephen mentioned there about oligarchs. I mean, it was kind of like 30 years ago when Michael Nyssen almost bought Man United for a ridiculously low figure of about £1 million. And then that was the first time you've really seen someone come in to try and buy a major English league club with a vision for making money out of them. And you know, United had a close call that one. You know, they managed to not sell the club to Michael Nyssen. And I dread to think where United would be now if Michael Nyssen had taken over. But you could see then the seeds of being planted in other businessmen's minds that there's a lot of money to be made out of football here. And from my personal perspective, you know, if I was United fan, I would just hate to be owned by the Glazers. The distance from the club, the contempt of the supporters, the money orientated ethos of the club, and you know, the owners in particular would totally turn me off from going to watch the team.
Matthew, come to you on this. I mean, Paul saying there about hating to be owned by the Glazers, and protest is all well and good, I guess. You know, Glazers out, FSG out, Kroenke out, Mike Ashley out, to quote my team as well. But where are all the kind and benevolent billionaires that can take over? You know, there's only billionaires can do this. And by their very nature, billionaires are not the most civic-spirited people.
No, and I mean, I would go as far to say there's no such thing as a good billionaire. I mean, to get to that level of like wealth, you need to have trampled over a lot of people and done a lot of bad stuff and to a lot of people to get that sort of wealth. So I think we've seen that with the issue with the whole Daniel Ek trying to take over Arsenal this week. Like, it's not the solution. That's not how we progress the game. It's not how you make things fairer, because there's no good billionaires. But for me, like, I saw this line from Miguel Delaney, the journalist for The Independent, which I think sums this up perfectly for me. You can't try and disrupt the entire fabric of the game and not expect disruption in return. There shouldn't have been violence, especially towards match day stewards, and they probably shouldn't have entered the stadium, what with, you know, COVID restrictions and making everything a sterile and safe place during a pandemic. But I don't know, I can't argue with the protest. United have been arguing, them protesting the Glazer ownership for 16 years, and the Super League has been a tipping point. And it seemed like a largely peaceful protest, and it did what protests are intended to do. They disrupted, they made their point. So yeah, I think it feels like a legitimate protest, and more power to them. Just, yeah, not with the violence.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what else comes, what repercussions may come, but what else this stirs up, and whether the momentum keeps gathering. But what stirred this up, of course, at the moment, is the Super League. So let's get into that little chestnut then. Super League was announced late on Sunday night a couple of weeks ago in what seemed almost straight away a fairly ill thought out plan. So 12 of their expected 15 founding members were announced, six from England, three from Spain and Italy. Conspicuous by their absence were, of course, the Champions League finalists from last season, Bayern Munich and PSG, which kind of made it seem a little odd from the start. There's reasons behind each of those not being there. But in there were sort of 9th or 10th place Premier League team with no Champions League appearances in 4 years, Arsenal. Also in were Tottenham, a team with barely any Champions League credibility at all, save for one admittedly impressive run to the final recently. But not coincidentally, with a big state-of-the-art stadium. So to start us off then, fellas, what were your initial thoughts when this was announced? I'll come to each of you on this to have a little reflect and rant and so on. But maybe start with you, Stephen, as the one with slightly more vested interest than the rest of us, even though I know your love for Man United isn't quite what it used to be. But you know, what were your initial thoughts when all this came and how it all played out?
Well, I think I just rolled my eyes in sort of nowhere near any kind of disbelief. I think it's been muted for so long. In fact, when I first heard it, I think it was a Sunday night when the news started to creep through. When I first heard it, I thought, oh, here we go again. We've heard this before. And before when it's been muted before, I always thought that this big breakaway that there might be some point down the line, some point in the future, would be to take these teams away from their domestic leagues into a European Super League that acted as their domestic league. I think that was what the general consensus was thought, that that might be what they had planned further down the line, a decade or so down the line. And I just thought that it were going to be some form of new news regarding that. And then by the next morning, it had moved very quickly to you'd got these high-ranking people quitting the jobs. We'd got emails going left, right and centre confirming all these machinations. And it was on. It was a different concept to what I thought it might be, but it was on. It was a definite. It was happening. All that had seemed to happen in the space of a few hours. So at that point, I was surprised with how quick it was happening, but I weren't surprised by the people involved at all. And I weren't surprised with the reaction of the fans, of the media. It was brilliant to see everybody on the same page, fans and media, left wing, right wing, fans of different clubs. Everybody just seemed to have the common consensus. No, I wish we could mobilise in the same way with regards to other things than football and be aware when things are being taken away from the man in the street to line the pockets of people in boardrooms, because it's happening all around us all the time. It's just that, you know, football, it's a chord with the man in the street, and that's why the reaction was as strong as it was. And it were nice to see. As you say, you never want to see these protests get into any violence. But in terms of if there was a reason to protest, I think it's very, very legitimate. Most of the protests that we've seen have been done in the right way, and it's great to see protests achieving the goal and to see those big clubs and the people in the boardroom with the tail between the legs were quite refreshing, to be honest.
Yeah, we'll definitely come on to the whole fan power thing, because it's certainly shown what can be achieved with a bit of collective will, hasn't it? Matthew, how about your initial thoughts on it all? As well, were you left with a sort of overwhelming feeling of just what is the point, like I was in terms of the game going forward?
I got angry. I got like angry really quickly. Like angry that this like bunch of rich old men had like the gall and the audacity to think that they have that much ownership over a sport so beloved by millions around the world that they could just like turn it upside down and irrevocably change it forever. It kind of made me reflect. Like I thought, like I got really angry on how we live in a society where like hyper-capitalism like this is like encouraged. Angry that like we'd seen this coming for like 20 years, ever since the Premier League was born out of Thatcherism, and you know there's these people, these billionaires running around knowing that there's this scope to make so much money from this. And to echo what Stephen said, I was kind of like annoyed and angry that we don't have this like furious response when it comes to other elements of football and society. Like, why don't we have this energy with when we see racism in football? Why aren't we this angry that like no footballer feels comfortable enough to come out as gay in the sport? Why aren't we more angry about our women footballers playing in really like horrid squalid conditions compared to their male counterparts? And I mean, I cap myself in this as well. Like, I'm a bit of a hypocrite when it comes to this. But then when I calmed down a bit, I sort of couldn't get over how I thought just how gross the idea was. Like this cold, empty, sterile purgatory of the league, like Real Madrid versus Barcelona every week for the next 23 years. It's like a dystopian nightmare. The reason why these games are so special is because they happen so rarely. Like, they mean something. Like, the Super League would be stripped of all significance otherwise. And like, lastly, I was sort of struck by how personal it was. You know, like, I really did feel like being in a playground and the bigger kid comes and steals your ball and says you can't play with it anymore. Like, we love football, you can't stop us playing, you can't stop us being involved. But then, like, it wasn't just me, it was, like, millions of people around the world all had this sort of really personal reaction and all sort of lent itself to the fury. So, yeah, the Super League and the sort of, in the biggest inverted commas, ever threatened that. So people reacted, and it was kind of really heartwarming to see.
Absolutely. So I like your comparison there to taking your ball away with you. That is very, very true. It is. It's stopping the rest play or have that dream, isn't it? But Paul, how about you as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'll try and come at this from a slightly different angle. I mean, I totally agree there and support what Stephen and Matthew have said so eloquently. So let's take the football side out of it. Can I just stress that this is not my personal opinion. We're just trying to present a different perspective so we have a wider debate about it. From a business point of view, the ESL makes sense, doesn't it? Because if all you're interested in is garnering money and increasing your personal wealth, then the ESL is the obvious way to do it. And so I'm actually quite surprised that the announcement took so long to come through, because I've been waiting for this announcement. Sure, Stephen has as well, from the United's perspective, for a number of seasons. So it didn't surprise me when it came. It just surprised me that it's taking so long to come. When you look at the American owners, you know, the Glazers, the Fenway Sports Group, etc. You know, their sporting exemplar is the NFL. They see the money the NFL generates. I mean, the latest TV deal for the NFL, I think, is $110 billion. Now, the TV monies the NFL generates actually wipe the floor with the Premier League and the Champions League. The NFL's always been the model for the Premier League chairman. And so, from their perspective, you know, the NFL, there's no relegation. The top teams face each other every week. So you can see from their point of view why they want to go for that model. You know, from their perspective, from purely balance sheet perspective, it makes perfect sense. And then you've got the equation of, okay, I mean, but you have to accept the fact that England as a football market worldwide doesn't count anymore. We're this quaint little country that speaks an antiquated form of English that no one in the States understands. The big market for these people is Asia. Growing population, prepared to spend money. And basically, this type of owner doesn't want the legacy football fan like you, me, Stephen, or Matthew. They don't want the season ticket holder who goes to the game every week and criticises the board and criticises the manager. That's just alien to them, because that doesn't happen in the NFL. What they want is the football tourist supporter who comes once a season, spends £300 in the souvenir shop, goes home with a load of 50-50 scarves and replica shirts, and never utters one word of criticism against the ownership. So from their point of view, I can see where they were going. Obviously, the whole idea, the whole concept of football is that every football fan can dream that their team, for example, I'm sure every FC United fan dreams that in 50 years' time, they could be playing United in a Premier League game. It's dreams to keep football alive. And when you take away competition, when you take away relegation, it just destroys the game. So from a business point of view, I could understand what they're trying to do. But for God's sake, guys, you've got to have some feeling of what the fans want, because the fans made this game.
Yeah, just picking up there on a point that you made, Paul. I think that it showed something in the feedback as well. You quickly saw Man City and Chelsea almost disowning it a little bit, in terms of we just sort of jumped in at the last second. It's not something that we're passionate about. I know exactly why they're not passionate about it, because they're the owners that aren't in it for the money. They've already got the money. Yeah. They want to put money in. It's all the owners that want to take money out that were so passionate about it. And at them clubs, and that's the way football's gone. You'll know we've done podcasts before where we've used terms. When I say we, I'll take responsibility for most of them. You know, the soulless vacuum that is the game now. Things like that is the impression that they give and the shameless about giving it. The problem is that the way that football is financed now, for on the pitch success is not directly related to the income that that club's going to make. When it was, when it always was, because you were successful on the pitch, so you got more TV time, you got fuller stadiums, your prize money was also quite vital to you. All them things have been taken away. That's not where they get their income from now. They get their income from global TV deals. They get their income from social media advertising. They get their income from all corners of the planet. Manchester United brag that they've got 500 million fans worldwide, plus they've got 142 million Twitter followers. This is what they care more about. That's what the people in charge of that club care more about. How well they do on the pitch has no relation to that, or very little. And it'd take a long, long, long time of complete football in obscurity before it had an effect on that and had an effect in their pockets. So they're just happy to let Manchester United be Manchester United, and they know that they are just going to take that money away and take that money away and siphon it off into wherever else they need it in their little empires with zero care for the fans, zero care for the actual success on the field. And while ever that's the case, we are going to have this issue because the idea of a legitimate sporting contest and everybody moving in the right direction would be that the people in charge of the finance, the people in charge of the boardroom need to move in a way that makes that club successful on the pitch. And that is what we need to get back to.
Yeah, totally agree, Steve. And the thing that you mentioned about Man United, about you know, boasting of 5 million supporters. Liverpool have the same thing about fans across the fans across the world. And it's going back to the NFL thing again. I mean, I kind of remember the 80s and 90s. You know, seeing people in city centres wearing NFL tops, never going to the game. But from the NFL point of view, they're the ideal fans because they just buy all the replica stuff. So yeah, totally support. You said there, Steve. Sorry, Matthew.
No, yeah, I totally agree with everything you said, and I can see, like, from these, like, the Dirty Dozen's point of view, you can see them thinking this is all about the money, this is all about, you know, increasing profit margins and reducing margin of errors, meaning that they can't lose the money. But so why was it so amateurish? Why was the entire thing so, like, poor and basic? Like, there's this this football writer that I follow, Grace Robertson, who she does these brilliant newsletters, and she made this point, like, they didn't sell it. They didn't, there was no marketing or advertising, no effort to convince people that this was a good thing, and, like, no acknowledgement of societal issues, you know, like racism or anything like that. There was, for all the talk of Allegri, like, monetizing sport in a different way, you know, charging the people for the last 15 minutes of games, like, there was no effort to make a brand. They were treating football like content, but they didn't do anything with it. It was just an announcement in a press release. It was pathetic. It was just so amateurish, soulless, and childish, and just so based on nothing. Like, all this talk about fans in Asia and young people not being into sport. Where are the facts for these? Where's the data? There was a report that Florentino Perez was talking about how young people aren't interested in football. He misread it. Like, the entire thing is false. It's misrepresented data. So I don't know, for all of this, like, sort of these, you know, these great business minds who are billionaires and, you know, make so much money and they're in this to make even more money, why was it so amateurish?
I wonder on that theme, Matthew, whether because there would be you know, it was leaked or exclusive coming out in some New York Times, wasn't it? Were the first to sort of come out with it. Do you think maybe the whole scheme was slightly taken by surprise that it came out, and then, you know, the clubs then put out their own statements, but the actual wheels behind it weren't set to go right away? Maybe, you know, the whatever they had planned to try and sell it was too late to kick into motion, and by the time, right, they never got round to in the end, of course, but maybe because the whole negativity had overwhelmed the whole thing by then, that they just couldn't.
I spent the last, like, 2-3 weeks, like, devouring, like, this, all this content, all these articles about this. So I've been reading a lot about it, and by all accounts, it was supposed to be launched sooner. It was supposed to be launched on the same day as, the anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster. But Liverpool pushed back and said no, because, you know, it's a bit uncouth to be announcing this on the anniversary of this. So it was supposed to be launched sooner. So they were just totally unprepared. They just had nothing. they hadn't even told people inside their own organizations, hadn't even told like what was it, Ed Woodward was brought in at the last minute and told like in the last, oh, this is happening, by the way. Like, it was just like, I hate to agree with Javi Tebas, the head of La Liga, but he said that the idea was the sort of idea you have at 5 a.m. when you're drunk in a bar with your mates. And it definitely felt like that. Everything down to the tacked on paragraph about women's football, which was just embarrassing, like awful. Nothing about it felt pre-prepared.
Now, another thing that Paul mentioned just a little while ago is referring to it as ESL. Now, we've all talked about European Super Leagues for years and years and years, as we've said, but that wasn't how this was pitched, was it? And this was just the Super League. It just happened to have European clubs in it at the moment. Now, going forward, that maybe I'm overly cynical, but, you know, that makes me think that they wouldn't be hosting games in Liverpool and Manchester all the time. It would be wherever they decided to, New York, Abu Dhabi, Shanghai, wherever else that they could get their crowds. I think that was part of what the scheme would have led to, and it would have gradually taken it away from the cities that they represent. So, yeah, in name and colour, possibly, they'd still represent those cities, but they would gradually move away. And then I guess possibly what might then follow is the franchise model that they so adore in the NFL. Where you can simply pick up a club and move it to a better market, as they term it. You know, they don't refer to clubs in the NFL or in NBA basketball or in baseball. It's not a club at all. It's a franchise. So it's a business entity. And that's where I think this was probably heading. You know, that feeds into the whole sporting integrity thing. I mean, that's been discussed plenty, of course, but I mean, it's just stunning how there was such a complete lack of appreciation of this. But I think, as you mentioned before, Paul, it was like the eyes on the American model, which, again, you know, that you can understand that from some of the owners, but, you know, this wasn't solely an American ownership-based thing. Florentino Perez and Andrea Agnelli were huge movers behind this. I mean, maybe they saw the dollar signs too, but, you know, it isn't solely laying the blame at the feet of the American owners. Paul, what's your thoughts there?
Yeah, I agree with what you said there, Aidan, but I do think it was the American owners who were pushing it because their first-hand experience of their own model. And just going back to, I just want to come back to what you said before about, you know, the ESL playing games in Abu Dhabi, Singapore, whatever. Well, that's the NFL model again, is that, you know, where like you have NFL teams playing some of their games on London Wembley Stadium, they're quite happy to move their games somewhere else to attract a wider support. And of course, you look at baseball, for example, you have the nonsense of the World Series when the only teams who play in the baseball league, you know, are from the US and Canada. So it's you know, you can see that the way they're going. And I always feel as well that these people look at all the sports to see ways of making money. I mean, it's never really worked out for the rugby league as such, but you know, I'm sure that the football authorities, owners, followed the Toronto Wolfpack experiments with a lot of interest, because for argument's sake, if that had taken off and rugby league had set up a franchise in North America, you can see football owners looking at that thinking, yeah, that could be a way forward here. You know, sports change all the time. You know, you look at what goes on with cricket now. You know, 10 years ago, someone suggested that there'd be an Indian Premier League with all the best cricketers in the world going to play cricket there. Then people wouldn't believe it. So I think we've always got to be prepared that change is going to take place, and we've got to be ready to fight that battle. But my huge concern is that it's the dollar signs. I just see the NFL model behind everything these people are trying to achieve.
Just quickly with you again, Paul. Obviously, Everton, your club, are in the process of building a new stadium. And obviously, there's other clubs who are excelling in the Premier League, Leicester notably, who would be well outside such a move. But, you know, for your case with Everton, you know, ploughing all that money into a new stadium to hopefully build the club and grow in a sort of more normal or perhaps old school way. I mean, what would the point have been for a club like that trying to progress in that way? It almost felt like wasted money right away.
Yeah, it's a good point, Aidan. I don't think that applies just to Everton. I think it applies to the 14 teams in the Premier League and the top half of the Championship as well. Because you know, progression forward is the raison d'être of any football supporter. And I think the implications for Everton as a club might have been that you know Mr. Moscheri might well have decided to renew his acquaintance with Arsenal and put his money back into supporting them if the ESL was where the money was going to be generated. And it's Matthew used before the phrase you know, a dystopian future of football, and that's exactly what would have been, because if winning the Premier League meant nothing, if winning the Premier League you know didn't guarantee you access to a Premier European competition, then I don't know what the point is. Well, one scenario I think might have happened is that the remaining clubs that weren't allowed to participate in the ESL would have then set up their own alternative European competition and tested the market for that, and that would have the advantage of like the Champions League holders Bayern Munich being a part of that competition as well. It also have the advantage of actually being a proper European league, not a league based on three countries. So that could have been one way forward. Personally, you know, if the ESL had gone ahead, I'd have been quite happy to wave goodbye to those six teams. I would have invited Rangers and Celtic to join the Premier League again. Look at our model and put ourselves as a viable competitive alternative to the ESL.
Going to you, Stephen, on this one. What we mentioned a little bit earlier there was regular clashes between Real and Barca or, you know, Man United, Liverpool. But would they be ostensibly any more exciting? Because many of them would be a mid-table clash with nothing riding on it. Would a mid-table clash between, say, AC Milan and Manchester United be any more exciting than mid-table clash between Newcastle and Crystal Palace, for example? You know, it's still a mid-table clash with nothing riding on it, but the names are different and the players are different. Is it any more exciting just because of the names? But essentially, it's a dull game with nothing riding on it, isn't it?
Absolutely. 95% of games in this European Super League were going to be dead rubbers, because what you're going to have in any natural league format is two or three teams that got off to a good start, pulled away at the top, and bear in mind that there were no relegation. You've got nothing else to play for. And at that point, as we've said, what football was built on was these dreams of playing against these clubs. To take that privilege of playing against them clubs and make it no longer a privilege, an entitlement, is using what football has been built on for all these years, all these decades, to then take that away just for your own advantage. I can't tell you how much it annoyed me. I can't quite put it into words. And I absolutely agree with Paul that I would have signed the six clubs out if it had gone through, if we hadn't have managed to move against it so well. As a Man United fan as well, bear in mind, I would have signed them out. I would have got rid of them from the old pyramid. No doubt about it. It's one or the other. You cannot have both. The European Super League, especially without Bayern Munich and Paris Saint-Germain and the other clubs involved, just a league of 12 teams that were so seemingly random when you look at where they are in their own domestic leagues, from just three different leagues in Europe. It would have made zero sense from a sporting point of view and would have left the sourest of taste in all those fans, mostly of the fans of them clubs. Nobody wanted to be part of it except the people at the top of these clubs. And as you say, it would just take away any sporting involvement, any sporting investment that anybody's had for all these years. And for just a series of dead rubbers that have been like, you know, Harlem Globetrotters on some kind of tour that means nothing. Yeah, right, so-and-so is going to win this match. Yeah, Real Madrid will win this one against Inter Milan. It's not going to make any difference to any league. It's not going to make any difference to the next season. It's not going to make any difference to the fans. It just is. It's just something that's happening. Imagine, all I can go back to is when I fell in love with football in the early 90s. If I were an 8-year-old boy and that were happening, I would run a mile from that sport. I would question what on earth my dad were doing with his time and his money watching this thing. I'd run away from it and I'd find something else to invest myself in. So no, for me, absolute non-starter. But I agree with Paul. I would have got rid of the clubs. I've got an emotional detachment from my own club now, which has been very much extended because of this. The weekend after it had happened, the actual closest club that I live to, closest big club, is actually Leeds United. A lot of my friends are Leeds United. It's almost like a choice that you make, a bit of a, you know, Leeds United or Man United, where I'm from. So they would have been the other choice. Now, I spent 20 years being so proud of my choice. And, you know, because they were dirty Leeds and all that kind of friendly rivalry. But I'm thinking, God, I'm glad I chose Man United when I was 8 years old. The weekend after it had all come about, Manchester United played Leeds. Now, I'm looking at Leeds United and I'm thinking, hang on a minute. They play a lovely brand of football, a manager that they're so proud of. You know, they've come back up from obscurity. I no longer felt like I could justifiably, morally, support Manchester United. And that's such a painful thing to think after all them years, but that's what it's driven me to, I'm afraid.
Well, to pick up that theme, Stephen, about betrayal of their own fans, you know, all clubs, thousands of them across the world at every level, they've all contributed to the history and culture of the game over the course of the last 100, 150 years or so. Now, to me, and Matthew, I'll come to you here, but there'll be a question at the end of this eventually, but I'll go on a little bit of a rant first, if you bear with me. I guess it's on the theme that Stephen was bringing up there about, you know, the sort of betrayal, if you like, of the fans and the contempt shown for the fans of those clubs, as well as the fans of other clubs. It's astonishing. But, you know, when I'm a fan of a non-Super League team, and I felt completely let down by the execs of those clubs who felt they could do this. But about the fans of those involved, to me, there must be some sort of betrayal of trust along the lines of what Stephen's mentioning there, you know, seeing another club and feeling slightly envious now. A weakening of the bond, perhaps, between the club and its fans. So for some, you mentioned earlier about City and Chelsea, you know, for some to hail them as being the first to perform a swift U-turn is kind of ignoring the fact that they'd be more than happy to join in the first place. They and the rest were willing to throw away their club's history, dismiss the loyalty of their fans and their support from home and around the world. Because, I mean, we mentioned global fans earlier, you know, the general feeling of dismay was felt by them as well, it seemed. I think they misjudged that totally. These clubs have shown that they couldn't give a stuff about their fans. You know, people should have perhaps known this all along. They do not care about you. They only care about your money. Maybe that's hit home a little bit now. But it hasn't for everybody. It's only about the money, nothing more, nothing less. There's been these faux apologies afterwards claiming to have listened to the fans. But to me, that's absolutely laughable. You know, if that was even remotely important to them, and this is all of these clubs, I'm not picking on any individually. If this was remotely important to them, they would have done so beforehand. To me, any swift U-turn doesn't erase any of what happened. And it would be a long road for me to forgiveness and no chance whatsoever of forgetting. That's very easy for me to say as a fan of a team on the outside, though. But do you think, eventually here's your question, do you think fans of Chelsea, Liverpool, Man United, etc. feel this betrayal? Stephen mentioned it there, but, you know, he's fallen a bit out of love with them over the years anyway. Those who were still, you know, regular, match-going, paying the money, etc., fully committed fans, will they feel this betrayal or will they forget as soon as the next new signings are bankrolled?
Nah, I think something's changed. Something has broken in football and like the bond between club and fan has been damaged. I mean, we've seen that today, what with the protests at Old Trafford and the protests that were at Liverpool last week and at Chelsea and wherever else the protests have been. I think there's been like a realisation that, and I think it goes beyond football. I think it's the realisation that people are realising we live in this society where everything is dictated to us by rich folk and there's nothing you can do about it. And it's like that's why I find, in a weird way, the whole thing kind of heartwarming, like seeing all the fans coming together and all with one voice protesting it. You know, the FSA, that numbers are going through the roof from people who are joining them. It feels like a groundswell. It feels like a movement that people, you know, can be transferred out of football. I mean, we've said this before. How many years have we been doing these podcasts or these sort of times where we talk about that link between politics and football, and we say that football can be that driving force that, you know, forces societal change in a good way. Well, now's the chance. This is it, man. This is the opportunity. This is where we have to take that energy and take that momentum into to changing things for the better and making, you know, redistribute the wealth, make the pyramid a better place than and a fairer place. So yeah, I think something's done. I think something's changed, and I think I like to think that this momentum will be continued and we'll see some real change.
In terms of these particular clubs, obviously one of the things that this coincided with was changes to the Champions League structure and new proposals from UEFA. Now UEFA, as much as there's no good guys in this situation, they probably come out of it the best just purely by chance that they simply weren't involved and got a bit blindsided by it. But, you know, the seeds of it all are, you know, they are as culpable as many others for the situation we're in. Constant drip feeding, appeasement to the powerful clubs, poorly implemented financial fair play, and, you know, a whole host of other things. But they've also come up with a really poor Champions League proposal. To my mind, that was confirmed the day after the Super League was announced. The Premier League's culpable as well. But do you think, in terms of the drive for money, but do you think this momentum in terms of the elite level of the game will see that Champions League proposal change now? UEFA might feel slightly emboldened, Stephen, do you think, to bring it away from that plan that was, you know, it was full of appeasement. You know, there was two places to be awarded on historical basis rather than on merit. There's this bizarre Swiss style league of 10 games played, but your points are tallied up against everybody else in one long list. That doesn't seem remotely as good as what the current Champions League is for all its faults. Do you think UEFA might change their plans?
Yeah, I think there's a case of not fixing what's not broken. And the Champions League format isn't perfect, but it's excellent and it's strong. I don't think I quite think the same about the Europa League. But no, I do think they'll feel emboldened by the fact that this has been squashed. So it's almost like the football world's shown some loyalty to UEFA. They've shown some loyalty to the domestic league structure, but they've also shown some loyalty to UEFA. And I think, they will now feel that possibly less change is required. Changes required periodically to keep things fresh. There's no doubt about that. Were it required to that extent in the Champions League? I don't think so. And I think that they will now realise that they'll probably have it mostly right and that European Super League is everything that people don't want. And yeah, I think they'll retract some of that.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what comes over the coming months, I guess, on that one. And to you, Paul, we touched on it already briefly. I think Matthew was talking about it before. But if any positive really comes from this, it's that the power of the elite possibly isn't as great as we'd all thought. You know, the threat, this sword of Damocles, if you like, that's been dangling over us for years of the Super League. And it was beaten in 48 hours. Now, I'm not for a second implying that it's not going to come back in some shape or form. Of course it will. Do you think, given that fan power as well has now been shown to work, Matthew mentioned a bit earlier, but will this be seized to force wider change? You know, Matthew's talked about issues of racism and so on, which has never seen, you know, this prompted the threat of government intervention, whereas the issue of racism doesn't seem to have done that, which I'm sure was just because it was an easy win that they didn't have anything to actually do in the end. But you know, there's other issues as well, fan-related issues, you know, overpricing of tickets, the TV subscriptions, the cost of replica kits, the ownership model, you know, the 50-plus-1 German-style model. Quite how you'd get from a billionaire owner to that is a whole other issue. But can this moment and mood be captured for these other causes? You know, you could bring in homophobia, sexism as well. Can it be captured for those issues? And if it can, will it?
Yeah, that's a really complicated question. I try and respond bit by bit. I come back to
can't make it easy for you, Paul.
you've learned well from Stu, haven't you? me going back to Matthew's point from before, I mean, I think it gives UEFA a unique opportunity. Now, it kind of felt, you know, when UEFA came up with the Swiss League proposal, it was like they felt it appeased the club's agitating for the ESL sort of concept. So it was almost like Neville Chamberlain coming back from Munich with peace in our time and reporting back to the house about it. And while he's saying that Hitler's invading Czechoslovakia, the ESL thing was like that. UEFA were about to announce this complicated league format at the same time the news about the ESL broke, so it took the ground away from them. They're in a unique position now because there's some, if you view this as like a poker game, the ESL have played their hands. Now, the key thing now is to watch in which way, in which manner UEFA respond to this. Are they going to have the balls to take these 12 clubs on? Are they going to be strong enough and resolute enough to, you know, impose some sanctions as regards their proposals for a breakaway league? So I think it's put them in a really strong position. I think in terms of fans being more united, I think you've already seen today that there's been lots of comments from other fans of the English ESL clubs criticising the coverage of the Man United protests. And so I just think fan unity across the clubs is going to be really, really hard to achieve. I think you can get a basic core consensus towards something. How far you can take that, I'm not quite sure. You raised a point there about, you know, about the Premier League, price of kits, price of tickets, etc. You know, yeah, I mean, that's something where fans can have an impact. You know, but that's a simple measure of refusing to buy the replica shirt. I mean, solutions like that are in the club's own hands. The problem is that it only affects the domestic market. If they're still selling billions of shirts in Asia, then they can still charge the prices that they want. In terms of the wider societal issues, yeah, I mean, football has a key role to play here, you know, and certainly, you know, how football's allowed the stain of racism to go unchallenged for so many decades, it's just unbelievable. And homophobia, I mean, why is there still not being one professional footballer prepared to come out and say that they are homosexual? Why is that in the women's game? That's valued, and women will come out and will support that they will make public their sexual preferences. But in the male game, that's a no-no. Everyone, the only people who come out are those who've retired after they've played the professional game. So I think in those kind of areas, we have an awful long way still to go. Hopefully this is a step in the right direction, but I think football and society's got a long, long way to go before we change those issues.
Yeah, just adding to that, it made me chuckle with disgust when I heard our Prime Minister claim that our rebellion against the European Super League has some kind of victory for Brexit. I could not believe the words were coming out of his mouth. Then I reminded myself, oh, what? And suddenly I did believe them words had come out of his mouth. And yeah, just continue on that point, the things that were about with racism and the other cultural things. These are the things that the government should get involved with. This comes, I'm really passionate about this. This comes from an education level. I'm from a small northern town, you know, and I know what people think, why they think it, and it's because they don't know. A lot of people do not know any better. They are not given the education. They're not given the tools to properly understand things outside of their immediate vicinity, and it's not always their fault. It needs to be widened out. It needs a broad approach, and that it does come from a government level, and that should be an education thing that we need to tackle, but we don't, because it doesn't, it's probably not a vote winner for them, that kind of thing, you know. That's what it is, but these things do need to change.
And Matthew, coming to you, obviously one of the key drivers behind this was the Real Madrid president, Florentino Perez, who coincidentally or not had pushed forward a presidential election to just prior to this announcement, which I'm sure was pure chance. Your thoughts on him and his involvement?
Yeah, I think it's really important to mention him because I think in many ways he's the main reason why this happened. Because this is all about, like, it's all about capitalism, and one of the things about capitalism is that everything needs to get bigger. Everything needs to have more money in every situation, even when situations dictate that might not be possible. They have to press ahead anyway. So you have clubs like Barcelona, Real Madrid, who can't accept a season without success. And so when Florentino Perez went onto that El Chiringuito, the radio show, and made all these ridiculous comments about the Super League, when he said that football was heading towards an Armageddon, was heading towards disaster, what he meant was just Real Madrid could finish fourth or something. he just meant that it's not the wider world of football that's heading towards disaster. It's just his world, Real Madrid. So you have Barcelona have debts of over €1 billion with a lot of that due for repayments this year. Real Madrid themselves have debts upwards of €900 million. Perez used the pandemic as an excuse, but these debts were accumulated like before that. They've overextended themselves. They've overpaid. They've spent horribly. And now the bubble's bursting. And that's what they're scared of. They can't handle the consequences. It's why the Spanish clubs were so desperate for it to happen and why they still are so desperate to happen. So, and like Perez said on El Chiringuito, like, this wouldn't help the pyramid. Like, this is the great argument for capitalism that, you know, the money filters down and everybody gets a piece. But it's been proven that doesn't work. And Perez has used this example, a really weird example of talking about Racing Club Lens in France. I don't know why he chose them as an example, but he said that they could get money by selling their best players, which I found just one of the most insulting facets of this entire thing. I thought that was appalling, like treating smaller clubs who aren't even small, by the way. Like, Lens are like a quite a big club and they have a really fervent fan base. Like, they deserve better than these insults, but treating them like paupers who are beholden to these all-powerful gods in Real Madrid and Barcelona, I thought it was atrocious. And I think Perez is a bad dude. And the only reason that this sort of stuff hasn't happened before is, sorry, the only reason this is happening now is because people can't say no to him. He's just surrounded by yes men. So he, I don't know. Yeah, so I just wanted to have a little rant about Perez, basically.
Well, no, spot on. Because, I mean, his complaints, one of the things he said that really made me chuckle in a slightly depressed way was his complaints about how the non-elite teams, you know, those below the top three or four in Spain were making money, whereas Madrid and Barcelona and Atletico were losing money. I mean, you know, the sheer gall to say, well, the solution to the fact that we can't budget properly and keep overspending is to give us more money, which we can then waste in a whole new variety of ways. Change your failing business model first. Like, look at your outgoings.
Who was it that spent €100 million Hazard and hasn't played in 2 years?
Like, well, quite. Yeah, he's not forced into any of this, is he?
I sat there on the evening when he was giving these interviews to El Chiringuito, just losing my mind at every single comment he made, where it was just, he's just the ramblings of an old man, and he has this, like, oh man, I don't know. He was just a devastatingly bad person and just the main driver behind the whole thing, and just, yeah. Just awful.
Well, one aspect of the Super League timing was, as we mentioned already, they struck while there were no fans allowed in the stadiums. Now, that moving slightly on from that theme onto something more positive, that's soon to change. You know, the League Cup final the other week had some fans in attendance. The Premier League is set to follow soon. So on this theme, Stephen, how do you think having fans in the stadium will impact on teams and their players? Now, will they embrace it, or could there perhaps be, on an individual basis, more nerves? You know, it's something they haven't had for a while. But I guess beyond that, what about the impact on the clubs who've been involved in the Super League? You know, the protests we've seen today, the chance for that to escalate is probably higher once the fans are back in the stadium. Not you know, aside from the impact on coaches under pressure and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it'll be largely embraced. I think everybody wants to see fans back in stadiums. But I do think this European Super League and the subsequent protests has added a complication to that. A big complication, because obviously we're now, there's going to be a certain element that's allowed to congregate in and around stadiums. And there's no doubt that that will be taken advantage of by people who want to go and protest further. I think we'll see a lot of booing and jeering inside Big Six club stadiums. And as you know, the problem with that is when you've got a lesser stadium, each almost individual voice can sometimes be heard. And I don't think that'll be very welcomed, because there's going to be some profanity, I think, and anger shown. It's going to be interesting to see. It's a shame that the point where fans are allowed back in stadium is going to be somewhat sullied now, or at least tarnished, because people are going to be more worried about what reception they get. But in terms of players, I think the majority of players are going to love it. I think it'll put an extra 10% on some of them's game. I think, you know, that's just sort of sunk into a level where certain players are different, certain players need that support, certain players just zone everything out, I think. But yeah, I think most players will love it. And I think those fans that are lucky enough to go back to the stadiums will love it. And it hopefully it'll just start it all coming back to some form of level of normality. And by the time we get to full normality, the European Super League is as far behind us as coronavirus.
Yes, by the time we get full stadiums, perhaps. But like Matthew, just finally on the Super League theme, obviously, you know, we might see more protests there. But what's your final Super League thoughts?
So, yeah, so this is going to be slightly hypocritical because I was incredibly against the Super League. But like a part of me was very intrigued to see a Premier League without the turncoats, like without the six turncoats. Like my delusionary, like fantasy part of my brain was dreaming of a league where the wealth and resources were equally distributed, and every year there was like something different with a new challenger, and you know, clubs and fans who don't usually experience this kind of success, like may have. Do you reckon there's any part of this that might have actually been good, like in terms of like just in England without these teams, would things have been more interesting? Would things have been, because I felt like it could have been an opportunity to make things fairer in Britain, if that makes sense. So I don't know what you guys think. Would there have been any positives from it?
And I think, yeah, I mean, to me, I'll pass it over to the other guys in a sec. I think for me, without them, you know, the money would have obviously been far less, which on one side, yes, fans' impatience and all of that would have been impacted, quality possibly drop off. But in terms of overall good, that could only surely lead to a more equitable structure. But would that structure have been, or equitable or not, would it have been as good without the biggest teams to pit yourself against? And I think that's what it comes down to. You know, we can all think, well, yes, it would be lovely to see the back of people who just don't give two hoots about the rest of the structure, but we're also reliant on them for, I don't want to say look up to, because we've all got our own histories and all got our own pride and so on. But, you know, it's the challenge of pitching yourself against the best that you still want to have. Everyone wants to strive to be the best. So that to me would be where losing those clubs would have been a real issue. Paul, what about you?
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating point that's being raised by Matthew there. I think whenever something happens, you've got to try and see where the benefits may have come from the incident. So I think one of the things that's been brought to the fore of the discussions again is the whole thing about power structures, both in UEFA and the Premier League, and the way a minority of clubs seem to be directing matters, making the key decisions. So I think if the outcome of this is at least to a review of the stewardship of the Premier League, and if it leads to a diminishing of the power of the so-called Big Six, and with more of the non-Big Six teams like my team and your team, Aidan, having a say in the future of how football is run, then I think that is a good thing as well. If it forces UEFA to get rid of this horrible concept of the Swiss-style Champions League, then that's been a positive as well. But I think it's also made fans question their undying loyalty to clubs, and maybe see behind the ownership of the clubs that maybe they do need to probe a bit deeper about things. Maybe they do need to ask a few more questions. I know that, you know, this German model, the 50+1 concept, is being pushed an awful lot at the moment. Now, hand on heart here, I don't understand an awful lot about how that works, so I'm no authority on it, but I do know that, you know, in Germany, Bayern Munich won the league for the last 9 seasons. Now, I don't want to be involved in the structure where the same team wins the league for 9 seasons. So I'm not quite sure how RB Leipzig fits into this 50+1 structure either. So I think if at least some questioning of how we govern football, then there's been some benefit from it undoubtedly, yeah. And the second main benefit, and Matthew and Stephen have both touched on this, is it's given fans an idea that actually, you know, they're not just a customer. They're not just someone who pays them for the season ticket. They're actually someone who can have a say in the order of their club, and their views matter and their voices should be heard more.
Okay, then belatedly onto some actual football. I mentioned the League Cup final a little bit before. We saw an insipid performance from Spurs there following the sacking of Jose Mourinho. Now, Stephen, you know, you've got history with Jose Mourinho at Man United. I mean, he's a manager who used to be great. At one time, and he's always divided opinion, but now well, at least used to. I guess maybe now he unites people in the impression that the game has moved on and passed him by. Is that fair? I mean, given your experience of him as well. And as a follow-up, would you think we'll see him pitching up at another big club ever again, or is his time gone?
It's what you define as big club, really. I don't think he'll be at, I don't think he'll be managing the European Super League, but hey, or a club of that ilk. I said it when he came to United. There was something about having him there that made you hope that it could rekindle something. But deep down, you knew that he wasn't. The game had passed him by. He had one style of play, and football is so cyclical with tactics and top managers finding a way to combat those tactics. You need to be fluid. You need to be tactically aware enough to know when everything needs to change. And that's not just during a game. It's from top to bottom. It's what Alex Ferguson was an absolute master of, staying on top when different tactics and different styles were coming in from Europe. And yeah, Jose couldn't do that, I'm afraid. He was a master of his one style. And when that got countered, as all these things do, we've seen it with Pep recently. I think Pep's probably coming out of the other side of a struggling period that he had. I don't think Jose ever could do that. I think he probably deserves a chance at a national team job. I think that's maybe where he'd be most suited. I know there's rumours that if Nuno moved on at Wolves, then perhaps because of the Jorge Mendes link and one thing and another, he could pitch up at Wolves one day. I just fear for any club now that I think he's getting more bitter with every job role, every failed job role. I think he even knows all this now. And yeah, certainly if I were a fan of Wolves, for example, I wouldn't be welcoming the thought.
As a side issue on Spurs, Paul, what colour shirt will Harry Kane be wearing next season?
I think there's a lot of speculation. But I tell you what shirts he won't be wearing. He won't be wearing an Arsenal shirt, so you can move that out the equation straight away. And I highly think it's not like that Mike Ashley is going to offer the Fulham Supremes in Newcastle either. So, Harry Kane, he's 27 now. So I think his next move is going to be quite crucial if he sees winning honours as being above his commitment to Tottenham Hotspur. So in terms of what clubs he could move to, well, I mean, Man United, Man City, to me, seems obvious choices. They've got the finances to offer the wage that he wants. They're both competing for major honours. I'm just praying he doesn't go to Liverpool, because that would just be something I couldn't take. But I don't see Kane moving abroad at the moment. Maybe towards the end of his career to over to the United States. I don't know. But I think, given the way football's finances have kind of been impacted by COVID, I'm not sure how many suitors there are out there with the type of funds and largesse to attract them. So it wouldn't surprise me if he was still at Tottenham next season. I think it could also depend on how he performs in the Euros.
Well, we shall see on all of that. Now, in other club news, Champions League, we've mentioned a lot this evening, but the Champions League semi-finals are partway through at the moment. In fact, some of it might be done and dusted before this comes out. But we already know that Manchester City have had a great result in PSG. Chelsea have also got a great chance of making it through. So we may well get an all-English final. But does it all feel a little bit hollow, Matthew, now given the Super League events, that these clubs, three of them anyway, were willing to throw away the Champions League? I know we're returning to all themes here. Willing to throw away that Champions League, European Cup, all of that history. Did this suddenly make PSG in the odd position of being the least hated of the four, given they hadn't signed up, at least for now anyway?
That's just another reason to hate the whole Super League, isn't it? To make PSG positioned as the good guys.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I kind of do feel kind of like, what's the point of the rest of the season? Because everything feels a bit tied up, and I do feel a bit, I guess, I don't know what the word is, desensitized maybe. Like, I didn't watch the Champions League because I couldn't do it. I felt a bit disassociated from it. There's only remaining football that I'm kind of interested in is the title race in France, which is going to be incredibly nervy and go right down to the wire. And I mean, I would say the same for Spain, but I feel a bit apathetic towards those Spanish clubs. And then the relegation battle in the Championship, which is going to the last weekend with Derby and Sheffield Wednesday playing each other in what is essentially a who wins secure safety. Although that has, depends on what Rotherham do midweek. But yeah, everything just feels a bit blur at the minute.
I wonder whether that'll still be the case if we do get an English Champions League final, because, you know, that might, at least in this country anyway, fire things up a little bit more. But we'll see on that one, I guess. But moving to the Europa League as well, Stephen. With your vested interest here, you know, your team are as good as in the final already, following their hugely impressive first leg victory. So will there be another All-English final there, or given Arsenal maybe not as strong, and Man United now the clear favourites to win this trophy?
Yeah, I think they probably are. It's from an on-the-pitch point of view, I'll be really honest, I've been quite very satisfied with United this season. I do think that there's a lot in that team to be proud of. You know, as we've said before, I'm somebody who almost needs that. I need to feel proud of my club. I need to feel that they almost represent me in some way. And I think that Marcus Rashford this season has been exemplary in making me feel like that. As you know, and Bruno Fernandes has got that kind of swagger about him that you want to see on the pitch for Manchester United. And yeah, I think that there's a good chance that they could finish with a major trophy and second position in the league. And yeah, it's difficult to argue that that's not a good season these days.
And that'll be Ole Solskjaer staying for a bit longer then, no doubt.
Well, again, I've took myself away from expecting them to win major trophies every year. That's not a priority anymore, really. It's just to get back to being proud of the club, really, being proud of the team. And in that respect, yeah, I do. I love to see Ole in charge, if I'm honest, just because of the era that I got swept up in as a United fan. And so, yeah, if they keep Ole and qualify for Champions League every season and continue to rebel against the Glazers, at this stage, I think that's all we can ask for as a United fan. Play the right style of football. With Ole, we've got some sort of links to the things that we're proud of. I think that's as satisfied as we can be at the minute.
More domestically, Paul, we talked a lot about relegation last month on this pod and the prospect of a potentially close fight for survival, but it possibly doesn't look that way. You know, since then, West Brom's initial surge has dissipated. Fulham have struggled to build on a few good results and performances. Meanwhile, Burnley, Brighton and Newcastle have been resurgent today, accepted, of course. But is relegation done and dusted now, do you think?
It was probably done and dusted 2 weeks ago, Aidan. But once Newcastle started winning and Fulham started losing, then the relegation battle as such ceased to exist. I mean, I think Fulham won one of the last five games, so they're down then. Yeah. But Brighton were always too good to go down, so there is no relegation struggle. West Brom were never going to stay up anyway. And I think, you know, the Sky and BT, in terms of publicising the glories of the Premier League, are going to have a problem towards the end of the season, because the only battle they're going to be able to hype up is the so-called battle for either fourth place for the Champions League or sixth place for the Europa League, or let's not forget the battle for seventh place for the Europa Conference League position. So I don't know how else they're going to push this. And I agree with Matthew, the Championship, the battle to stay up this season is going to be absolutely fascinating, as are the playoffs to join the promoted two as well. I think, once again, the Championship has a level of competitiveness that the Premier League can only dream about. And, up and down the League One, League Two, there's just been so much going on with situations changing by the day. And you get things like, Harrogate Town beating Cambridge 5-4 to stop Cambridge getting the 1 point they need to get promoted. I'm fielding an understrength team because we're in the FA Trophy final on Monday, even though the Football League Club is still trying to work that one out. I think at the top level, relegation is done and dusted. And I think, Steve Bruce is not a popular figure in your part of the world. I understand that. But I think he's done what Ashley asked him to do. The staying up, and hate to say this, his recent record as a manager has been best than Carlo Ancelotti.
Well, I think I know who I'd rather have longer term, Paul. But yeah, you're right. You know, bit of credit. I've slated him enough. A little bit of credit for, I say a little bit. I'm not going to go overboard for the last month or so. How much of it is down to him, I question. But yeah, you know, he has done what Ashley wants, assuming they get maybe one or two more points to to really seal the deal. Because, you know, everybody's still nervous until it's mathematical, let's be honest. But we'll see. But you're right there about the championship, Paul. Now, Matthew, you know, you're our go-to guy there. And automatic promotion's obviously sorted with the return of Norwich and Watford. But at the bottom, Wayne Rooney and Derby County are still in huge trouble, while your Birmingham City, they've climbed well clear under their new management, haven't they?
I've never been so unbothered by a 4-0 loss as I was yesterday. You know, it was fine. It's all good. Like, he put the kids in. They didn't do great, but it didn't matter because we're safe, and that's all that matters at the minute. But elsewhere, yeah, no. Derby County are dropping like a stone. They are awful, and the initial bounce that they got from Rooney joining has completely gone, and they're in this. I really worry. I think they're down. They're relegated. I think it's just down to whether Sheffield Wednesday or Rotherham stay. Or Rotherham, if they can get a win in midweek against Luton, which is entirely possible, then the momentum's with them. But then there's problems at Wednesday as well. Like, there's reports that they didn't get paid again in the last month, not the players. So, you know, I don't know what sort of impact that has on, you know, players going into the last week of the season if they haven't been paid. But, yeah, it's fascinating. I think that game next week with Derby play Sheffield Wednesday is going to be a tense affair. Because they're both pretty bad, but it's going to be a very interesting game.
That's certainly one to keep an eye on, yes, because it's a fairly sizable club in big trouble no matter what way it goes, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. But good for you that you're out of it all, so you can relax for the last few weeks. Okay, we'll move on a bit there. So it's a chance now for our guests to set the agenda, picking a subject of their own, like positive, negative, or whatever you like. So, Stephen, coming to you first.
It once again struck me with the fine form of Phil Foden and the fact that he's often keeping Raheem Sterling out of the Manchester City side these days. It just struck me that Gareth Southgate's got a real headache in that position, those positions in behind Harry Kane. I think whether it's a 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1, that's down to a little bit of semantics, really. I think we're still going to play with one either side of Kane and one in behind. And I think we've just got such a plethora of options that all seem of a similar sort of standard, a similar sort of form level. I'm very interested to know, as we get closer to that tournament, what we think or what you guys think would be the three that will get the nod. So I've listed eight that I can think of. Feel free to add more to it. But I've got Phil Foden, Raheem Sterling, Marcus Rashford, Mason Mount, Jack Grealish, Jesse Lingard, Jadon Sancho, Maddison. I've thought about this, and I think that the three I would pick at the minute are so completely different to what I would have picked a few months ago. That's where I think the headache comes from. I'm going with Sancho, Mount, and Foden. So yeah, over to you, Paul.
Thanks, Stephen. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a difficult decision. I mean, the encouraging thing is all these players you mentioned are really, really in good form at the moment. I have some reservations about Maddison, particularly, you know, with one or two recent sort of social lapses. Just put a bit of a question mark against his character. And I think Southgate sets quite strong store about how people conduct themselves away from the squad as well as in the squad. So I don't mean he's going to make it particularly. Hope Grealish is fit. I love watching Jack Grealish. Yeah, I love watching players of his ilk. Sorry, Matthew, didn't mean to offend you there. And also as well, I mean, Phil Foden's just been a revelation this season, hasn't he? So I definitely am Phil Foden. Did you mention Lingard as well there, Stephen?
I did. I think he's played his way in. I think Gareth Southgate. I think Gareth Southgate likes him. I think he was unselectable for a long period of time. But now he's played himself into contention. I think Gareth Southgate likes him.
No, I totally agree. I think Southgate trusts him as well. And I think you need someone, if you're going for a younger midfield with likes of Grealish and Foden and Mountain, I think you need a midfielder with international competition experience. And obviously, Lingard's got that World Cup experience behind him as well. So from my perspective, I would definitely have him in the team as well. So I don't know if that moves the debate on any further. But Maddison, I have a question mark about, but the other ones I'm happy with.
Matthew, how about you then?
Stephen emailed about this earlier today. Like, spoiler alert, these are a bit pre-planned, but I've been looking at the squad all day. I even did a build my own squad for on the Sky Sports app, but I don't really know. I had Calvert-Lewin as a backup, even though I know he hasn't been the most prolific prolific forward lately. But for my money, I think Harry Kane starts. Jadon Sancho is a must start if he's fit. I think Lingard has played his way in. And I'm going to steal the point of a friend of my brother's. This is a bit elaborate, I know, but he believes that Lingard is like the heartbeat of the England side. He was a big reason why there was such a good atmosphere in the 2018 World Cup. So for that reason, I think he's going. I think Mason Mount is going to start as well. So yeah, I guess Kane, Sancho, Mount, Foden at the minute on form. And then I think Sterling's dropped a little. I think that's the strongest at the minute.
Yeah, I would be similar to you on that, Matthew. I think Foden has to be the one that it's kind of centered around now. I think he is so good and so dynamic and, you know, inexperienced, sure, but I think he is so good and in such a peak that he's the one to build a lot of it round. I think Rashford is he's having a terrific time, and he's already used part of the World Cup as well. You know, he's already fits in well, and I think he works well with Kane. I could see Sancho in there too. That I guess what all this has shown is that there's huge numbers of options to go with, and it's an incredible problem, albeit a good one for Southgate. But I guess maybe that makes it harder that you know, whichever way he goes, it is going to leave out somebody really, really good. I guess the extension of the squads now to 26 may allow a few more of these to actually make the trip, because some of them probably wouldn't have even made the squad. He does seem to prefer Mount to Grealish when it comes to choosing that position. So possibly Mount will get the nod there. But I think you could see, obviously, Kane with Rashford and maybe Sancho either side, and then possibly Foden and Mount with Henderson backing them up behind those three. I don't know. Maybe I'm putting far too many of them in one team. I'm not the tactical expert. But we'll see how that goes. Anyway, other questions and Matthew, or other moments, sorry. Matthew, how about your subject?
For a lot of people around the world, we are in the middle of Ramadan, the holy month of the religion of Islam. Muslims, as we know, will fast from dawn until sunrise, meaning no water, no food, nothing can pass the lips. It's meant as a time of reflection and a time to be more generous and understanding of others. But this is obviously something that is very difficult for athletes, as part of their job requires them to be like fully hydrated. But the other day, during the Premier League match between Crystal Palace and Leicester, the game was paused momentarily after 30 minutes to allow Leicester defender Wesley Fofana and Palace midfielder Jake Ucuyate to break their fast and take on some fluids. And this is the first time it's ever happened during a Premier League game. The pause lasted less than a minute and was agreed beforehand by the club captains, the referee and the managers. And it's not just that. There's been a big push this year within the footballing industry for more awareness about Ramadan. The Athletic reported that Nujum Sports, which is a non-profit organisation that seeks to support and empower Muslim athletes, have spoken to the media, spoken to the Premier League to help them like better understand how to look after their Muslim athletes. They've offered them boxes containing various Muslim-related things, such as dates, prayer beads, honey and zamzam water, which is holy water from Mecca. It's been delivered to over 200 footballers in the night too, in the pyramid. And Crystal Palace published a great video featuring Kouyaté and the club doctor, Zaf Iqbal, explaining Ramadan and how footballers cope. So Ramadan ends on May the 12th, which means there's about 15 games to take in place in that time, where the game will likely be paused for Muslim players to break their fast. And I think it's great. I think Ramadan is like a really important month. It involves families and friends coming together at sunrise, sundown to perform iftar, which is the meal that breaks the fast, and that's not possible right now. Like, this year has been obviously very difficult with the pandemic, so moves like this I think are really hugely important. Shows empathy, understanding and acceptance of religious requirements. I think it's a small thing, but I think it's a great thing. I think it's excellent.
No, that's a really interesting point. It has for a long time been problematic for sports people, of course. So this is a real positive move, and it is real, showing willing to understand, I guess, which is possibly something that's been lacking previously there. Paul, over to you.
Yeah, I think I'll try and finish off with three very brief points about the joy of football. I'm going to change slightly what I intended to talk about, Aidan. So, one, brilliant that Wigan Athletic didn't get relegated after the 12 months that they've had with financial penalties. The club put the chairman put into administration to eventually manage to stay up in League One this season. I think gives them lots of hope for the future with the new owner taking over as well. Second point, we talked about it before. To me, the best results I had on Tuesday night was the Barrow had won away 2-0 the Forest Green Rovers to stay in League Two after a 50-year absence. If they'd gone down, back down to the National League, that would have been absolutely awful for the town and for the region of Cumbria as well. And finally, you know, we've talked a lot about the Super League tonight, and I'm a bit of a footballing animal, particularly as regards footballing history. And 70 years ago today, in the Third Division North, New Brighton FC beat Chester 1-0. It was their last ever win as a football league club. During the summer, they were they failed to gain re-election. Workington took their place in 1951. Now, if you go to New Brighton now, the ground's not there. There's no plaque there to say the club played there. There's no indication that New Brighton had a football league team of 30 years standing. It just kind of disappeared from history. And I think the point I'm trying to make here is that if you've got a local lower league team crying out who need better gates, if you've got a local non-league side near to you, go and visit your local team. Go and visit your local non-league team. Support them, get behind them, because communities need their football. And you know, it's such a shame when a town or city loses a football league club. And I don't any football, any clubs, as a result of COVID, to be struggling financially going forward in the future. So I think to anybody who's listening here, if you've got a spare Saturday afternoon when fans are allowed back in, particularly in August, go and watch your local non-league team.
Well said, Paul.
Excellent point. Yes. Okay, then, we're busy as ever across the other platforms at these football times at the moment. Our next magazine will have been released by the time this comes out, so I'm not giving anything away in saying it's focused on Valencia, a club who hit great heights a couple of decades ago, and dare I say it, a fine example of a club who shouldn't be denied the opportunity to rise to that level again.
Exactly.
Yes. That will be released alongside another popular old edition, which is in fact the original These Football Times magazine, the Argentina edition. So as ever, they're sure to be selling out fast. So don't delay on that one. But we will finish there for tonight. Thank you all for your terrific contributions as always. Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, Aidan. Yeah, very meaty discussion there. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Meaty and therapeutic in some ways, I'm sure. Matthew, thanks as always as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Fascinating talk as always. Yeah.
Spot on. And cheers, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Aidan. Thanks for having me on the show again. And thanks to Matthew and Stephen. I loved your insights into the game. It's good to get a different perspective from different people who are fans of different clubs as well. So thanks, guys.
Cheers, Paul. Same to you.
Yeah,
cheers. Cheers.
And thank you to all of our listeners too. I hope you've enjoyed this discussion and you'll join us again next time with these Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.